So let's do this. All y'all tune out the political news for half an hour. We will bring you up to speed on the global economy. That work for you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 12th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Look, I totally get it. Lots of political news this week. I have been watching myself. But as has been heard once or twice on this program, the economy waits for no one. So here we are, ready and eager to meet the need. Kate Davidson's at the Wall Street Journal. Gina Smilek is at the New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai. Hey, Kai.
So we are going to keep it really high level and big picture, Kate, and we're going to start with you, and we're going to do it through the person of one Jerome Powell, the chair of the Fed, who gave a big speech and a Q&A at the Economic Club of New York today, in which he once again basically begged Congress to do some relief. He called it an essential tool. But he also said it is not just fiscal or monetary policy. It is a society-wide commitment that has to be undertaken to fix this economy. Do you think the Fed chair's pleas are falling on deaf ears once again?
I think that's a good question. I don't think they are. I think actually we're seeing an interesting sort of a really interesting dynamic here where you have the current Fed chair and the former Fed chair, who's now the Treasury Secretary, and they're quite a formidable team, it would seem. They're really pairing up and together making this argument, which I think perhaps gives it even more heft, that it's really important right now for the economy to and the American households and businesses really is what we're talking about, to get more support. And so I think that, you know, if it's just, you know, if it's just the White House or it's just maybe other economic advisors of the president saying this, maybe there are people who think, well, you know, of course they're going to say that they want to advance this big, huge package. But I think it really means something when it is the Fed chairman who's backing up those calls. But we will see, right? I mean, we know that there's still not a huge appetite among Republicans for a big package. Some Republicans are willing to do something smaller. So I think we're still seeing how this is going to play out. And obviously, Democrats are not so confident that they, you know, they're reserving this option of reconciliation, this, you know, arcane budget process to try to do this if they need to with just a simple majority.
Gina, what do you make of the argument about so that some are making that it's just too much money? $1.9 trillion is more than the economy needs right now. We're going to have inflation and bad things will happen if we actually plow this much money into the economy. What do you make of that?
You know, I think there are some really interesting questions there that I think are sort of incumbent upon anyone who says we're about to have this massive inflationary spike to answer. And I think the chief one is just, where is it coming from? You know, I think there are really obvious places where you can point to that we're going to have short-term price spikes. Like, that is going to happen this year. Inflation is temporarily going to go higher unless something really surprising happens. That said, a temporary price spike and the kind of inflationary process that monetary policymakers like Mr. Powell worry about are not the same thing. You know, like a one-time increase or a couple of months of increase in airfares is not the same as an inflationary process where you have wages and prices spiraling upward month after month after month. And I think that latter kind of process, we just haven't seen it in decades. And I don't know. I think that the thing Powell has said, and I think a lot of economists are saying, is you kind of have to make some sort of case for where that's going to come from before you can really get too far with predicting inflation.
Well, so let me throw this out there, Kate, as one possible thing that might happen. And that is, once we can all travel and spend and join and drink and eat and all of those things again, we're going to unleash a huge amount of consumption in this economy. There's going to be pent up demand, and we don't really know what's going to happen when that happens.
Sure. I mean, that's one argument. I saw someone on Twitter saying people aren't going to take, you know, multiple vacations because of the ones they missed. I don't know, Kai. I'm certainly going to try.
Yes. I think everybody in this conversation is, for sure.
But I do think the past year has taught us that, you know, maybe assumptions that we had about consumer behavior were maybe a bit off. So yeah. Who knows, right? Like, we'll have to see how this plays out. It might play out over a long time horizon. I think we're assuming once we all get vaccinated, it's like a big party, but maybe not. We kind of still have to see. But I think that the counter argument that some policymakers are making, and in particular, you know, the White House economic advisors, are that, you know, the Fed has the tools to deal with inflation. If we do, in fact, see the kind of inflation that Gina's talking about, that the Fed would worry mm-hmm. about, they can raise interest rates, but they can't lower them anymore. And that's why there's this argument that fiscal policy really needs to step in and do a lot more. And there's absolutely questions around, well, how much more, and what's, you know, what is the best kind of stimulus? What's the most helpful to support people and support the economy? But I think that at least the people that the president listens to, I don't think they are convinced or worried that inflation, we're going to have a big inflation problem.
Gina, are you going to take an extra vacation or two?
I'd like to. I hope so.
Wouldn't we all? We'll check with the people in the New York Times. All right. So I said we were going to keep it high level. I'm going to get down in the nitty gritty just a little bit and ask you about the relief package. $1.9 trillion as it stands now, probably going to pass through budget reconciliation, but maybe not all of it. I wonder, Gina, what you make of the relative importance of relief checks at $1,400 to fulfill the Democratic campaign promise versus bumping up unemployment benefits and or conceivably keeping the minimum wage in this bill somehow?
You know, I think they're all policies that do really different things. And I think it really depends on who you're talking to when to sort of assess how important they are. You know, $1,400, that is politically an extremely important part of this package. You know, as you mentioned, it was a campaign promise. So I think you get a lot of folks sort of weighing in on that front. The minimum wage, I think there are a lot of folks who say this is a great poverty alleviation tool. It like has the effect of not just lifting people who are actually making the minimum wage, but also lifting incomes for people who are close to the minimum wage. So that could be potentially positive. It could potentially come with some drawbacks in terms of, you know, lost jobs for folks with lower wages. Mm-hmm. And then I think you get, when it comes to sort of this unemployment insurance, I think you get pretty broad-based agreement that that's an important part of this policy package, because there are still 10 million people who used to have jobs pre-pandemic who do those jobs no longer exist. And so there is this element of how do we get those folks to the other side of this crisis?
Yeah. So, Kate, on that other side and the timing of this thing, just on the way out here, it's worth a note that the current relief package, the benefits in there expire in the middle of March. Do we think Congress gets this done by then?
I don't know. Nancy Pelosi certainly seems to think they will. I think she said this week, you know, they're aiming for by the end of February. So I don't know. It seems pretty tight. But hey, if they do decide to just go forward with reconciliation, I think they can do it. But it is important to remember they need like really a couple weeks buffer. You know, middle of March, benefits expire. That's kind of too late, as we saw at the end of December. Yeah. It's really hard for states. You know, they have to essentially stop and then restart if there's a lapse. That can take a long time. People can miss some of those checks in the meantime. So I think they really want to avoid that this time, they being the Democrats.
Yeah, there's a whole logistics piece of this. Kate Davidson at the Wall Street Journal, Gina Smilek at the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thank you. Thanks, Guy.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, I mean, more record highs, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You might not have known this, but there is an official start to tax season. That is when the IRS will start accepting and processing returns. And it is today. Later than usual, because like all the rest of us, the already short-staffed Internal Revenue Service has had a tough time getting things done in the pandemic and has had to figure out how to get two rounds of relief payments out, so they're a little behind. Deadline is, of course, the same, though, 15 April, so things are likely to be a bit stressful at the tax agency the next couple of months. And as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, more stressful than usual for a lot of filers as well.
Taxes may be a bit more complicated this year, especially for people who lost their jobs or had their hours cut back.
Well, a lot of people don't realize that when you get unemployment, it's taxable. So they might not have had adequate withholding.
Keith Fogg is a professor at Harvard Law School and runs the federal tax clinic there. Also,
last year, a lot of people are pulling money out of their retirement accounts to try to make ends meet, which is creating more taxable income.
All this is on top of the normal stress many experience during tax filing season. Lynn Bufka is a senior director at the American Psychological Association. She says one way to deal with the stress is to grasp control where you can.
We have some control over when we start the tax process. We have some control over trying to have our records and materials organized in a way to make it more efficient. That helps us manage stress.
Another tool? Free tax prep. Laura Schurler is with United Way Worldwide, which partners with the IRS to offer the services in many communities.
You know, there may be people out there who have never used free services before because they've never needed to.
But of course, 2020 was different. And says Schurler,
especially if you're having trouble paying your bills, buying groceries, affording your utilities, tax preparation is not something that you have to spend money on.
And in many cases, our own tax dollars pay for the service. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
As long as we're on taxes, one more along those lines. The state of Maryland is set to become the first in the country to tax the billions of dollars that big tech companies are making selling online ads. Google, Facebook, and Amazon, most prominently, of course, at a rate of 2.5% to 10% of ad revenue, depending on the size of those sales. Or, I believe the technical term is a boatload of money. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now from Baltimore, it's not quite a done deal.
In its first year, the Maryland tax on digital ads would raise an estimated $250 million. State Senator James Rosapep, a Democrat from College Park, says the money the firms pay would go to schools.
These companies have built their businesses on the public investment in public education. And so we said, look, let's dedicate the money from these folks to making our education system even better. That'll be good for the people of Maryland, but it will also be good for these companies.
Maybe so, but Doug Mayer represents a coalition of businesses and tech industry groups that's been fighting the tax. He says local shops and restaurants that advertise on Facebook and Google will end up paying for it.
When the cost of those ads go up, the business buying those ads needs to adjust for that. They're going to increase the cost of the items that they sell, which then falls down on the consumers.
There's likely to be a legal fight ahead. Jared Walczak at the Conservative Tax Foundation says federal law prohibits taxes that single out e-commerce.
You can tax all advertising, but to create a tax on digital advertising without an analog component violates the Internet Tax Freedom Act.
Still, other states, including Connecticut and Indiana, are considering similar measures. Jessica Lee is a partner with the law firm Loeb & Loeb, which counts large tech firms among its clients. She sees the effort as part of a larger backlash against big tech and the business model of harvesting personal data to sell targeted ads.
A tax is not going to persuade a company who has over $15 billion in ad revenue to change their business model. I just don't see that happening.
Doing that, Lee says, would take more comprehensive federal reform. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There you are, Monday morning up early on a holiday looking to catch up on the business and economic news. Sabri Benishour is in for David Monday on the Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. Coming up,
I would tell the Chinese government, okay, you don't want to change, we'll change.
The times, as they say, are a-changin' with China trade. But first, sure, yeah, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 27 points today, less than a tenth percent, 31,458. The NASDAQ picked up 69 points, about a half percent, 14,095. S&P 500 scraped together 18 on the point scale, four-tenths percent. 39 and 34. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 1%, the NASDAQ gained 1.7%, the S&P 500 tacked on 1.2%, Wall Street, as I said earlier this week, gonna Wall Street. The latest big company to shift to a very flexible work model in the aftertimes. I'm sticking with that. The aftertimes. Trademark it right now. Spotify. The music and podcast streamer said today it would let employees choose whether they want to be in the office full-time or part-time or not at all, whatever works. There's a choose-your-own-city or country element as well. I might be applying for new employment. The company's going to arrange for co-working spaces for remote workers who still want dedicated places to go. Spotify up 2.3% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In what is perhaps not a surprising development, online alcohol sales, says the consulting firm IWSR, have grown 80% during the pandemic, 80%. And IWSR says the U.S. e-booze market, which is a thing apparently, will pass China this year to become the world's biggest. Marketplace's Scott Tong drew the lucky assignment today. Put in an online alcohol order, just one. Thank you, Scott. And tell us what you learned about the growing drink-from-home economy.
Okay, so I'm on the website of this Arlington, Virginia restaurant where I am. It's called Ambar. And I'm ordering something called a Sarajevo Old Fashioned. Now, it's a little early in the day here, yeah, but it's surely 5 o'clock in Sarajevo. Ordering a cocktail from home was not really a thing before the pandemic. But Chris Swanger, the CEO of the Distilled Spirits Council, says when the virus hit, state lawmakers pivoted.
Cocktails to go has been a great phenomenon. Over 33 states have adopted cocktails to go, and that's been an economic lifeline for many of those establishments.
Another piece of the online booze explosion is consumer awareness. Brandy Rand is with the beverage online consultancy IWSR.
Most people weren't aware that they could purchase alcohol online. So when we saw the pandemic hit, we saw the adoption rate really just skyrocket.
She says this trend actually began before the virus, picking up steam even through a patchwork of restrictions and regulations. Every state has its own rules. And in the U.S., alcohol has to flow from a producer to a distributor to a retailer. Jordan Burke at Tomorrow Retail Consulting predicts that big companies in beer and wine and e-commerce will start getting creative, such as this tie-up in China during the 2018 World Cup.
Customers could use the Walmart app to order cold Corona or Bud beer, and we would deliver it within 30 minutes, and it was an enormous success.
What's in store for American drinkers?
Customers are going to be getting free alcohol delivery pretty regularly.
Free delivery. That's better than my drink order, which requires pickup. So off I go. In a hurry, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
President Biden had his first conversation since taking office with Chinese President Xi Jinping this week. There was some giving and some taking from both men, according to the summaries provided. Among them, Mr. Biden criticized what he called Beijing's coercive and unfair trade practices. And there is the Trump trade war, which continues, by the way. But also, there's a fundamental difference between the world's two biggest economies. China makes more stuff than any other country in the world. Manufacturing is what that is. The United States leads in services. And American companies that sell those services really want to get into the Chinese market. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore in New York and Jennifer Pack in Shanghai explain, the going's really tough.
Depending on who you ask, China's restrictions on foreign companies are manageable
or impossible. Take David Livdahl. He's a retired partner at U.S.-based Pillsbury Law Firm. He's tried for decades to open legal offices in China.
We can hire Chinese lawyers, but they have to give up their license when they join an international law firm. And so we can't do any litigation. A lot of Chinese ministries refuse to let us appear with clients at regulatory meetings.
A pretty big obstacle. That's because China bans foreign investment in most Chinese legal matters.
And at the same time, gives tax benefits to Chinese law offices.
They work half the time and make more money because their taxes are much lower.
Then you've got people like Roberta Lipson. She's CEO of United Family Healthcare. It opened its first hospital in China in 1997.
We now have 7 hospitals going on 9.
Now, her company's only allowed to own 70% shares in those hospitals. Overall, though, she says her experience in China has generally been positive.
Just yesterday, I had a lengthy call with the person responsible for looking at the regulatory structure for foreign investment in healthcare, asking what our challenges were and what were the barriers to entry.
2 U.S. businesses, 2 very different experiences. It all makes sense if you take a long view, says Benjamin Schobert, author of Blaming China. It might feel good, but it won't fix America's economy.
There's a very repeatable life cycle that the Chinese government goes through once you start to look at any of these sectors.
He says China's government will conditionally allow in industries that it needs or that it needs to learn from.
As those industries mature in China, the Chinese government tends to say, okay, we got from that foreign industry what we wanted.
Like investment, intellectual property, know-how, Schobert says.
And now we're going to start to have a pronounced bias in favor of our own domestic companies.
Different industries are at different points on that life cycle, he says. So remember Lipson, the healthcare CEO? She's been able to gain traction by offering a high-end service to more affluent families, filling a need.
A need that Lipson's longtime patient, Tang Liang, was desperate for. She once gave birth at the best Chinese hospital in Beijing, and she says the experience was terrible.
When I say terrible, probably, you know, it's a very emotional word. But I just didn't feel comfortable when the doctor was not very nice, very kind when you are in pain.
In many public hospitals, wait times for procedures are long, Lipson says. It's hard to get beds, and some doctors take a traditional Chinese approach to medicine, while some patients prefer a more modern approach.
Just walk into any top Chinese public hospital, like this one in Shanghai. It hires the best doctors, and people across China come to see them. So public hospitals are often overcrowded, chaotic, and usually you see whichever doctor is on duty that day. And to avoid all that, Tang is willing to pay a lot more to go to one of Lipson's hospitals. More and more middle-class Chinese families are willing to spend on healthcare. Eric Chung is with a hospital ranking firm in southern China called Gaha.
Healthcare expenditure in 2019 is almost $1 trillion U.S. dollar, okay? And it represents 6.6% of Chinese GDP.
Despite Lipson's success, U.S. providers are a tiny piece of that pie. And you've got lots of other industries where U.S. firms are barely making a dent.
Like banking, media, transportation, telecom. Sometimes it's a clear national security issue. Uncensored News, Facebook, China's Communist Party sees those as threats to stability.
But there are lots of other industries where foreign investment is restricted to help domestic businesses. Livdahl, the lawyer, has watched his domestic Chinese competitors benefit from all the obstacles he faces, even poaching staff.
So we're kind of like a training ground for the last 20 years for, you know, international legal training in China. But it's very hard to retain good talent with that unfair tax regime and also the fact that our Chinese lawyers can't do any litigation.
Meanwhile, his competitors thrive within China and overseas.
They've got offices in Tokyo, New York, New Jersey, Silicon Valley, London, Rome.
China argues it is opening up its markets. It's got an official policy to do so, called reform and opening up.
But by the time that opening up occurs, local companies can dominate and it's too late for foreign companies. So how to improve access for foreign companies? Lipson's advice is to tone down the hostility between governments.
Engagement by the U.S. over the last 25 years have managed to improve that situation.
But for the David Livdahls in industries with less luck, one hears calls for another approach.
Reciprocity. I would tell the Chinese government, okay, you don't want to change? We'll change. We're going to adopt your model. If we had kept out Alibaba and Tencent and Baidu initially, they either stay out or they come in once the Chinese open up for our companies.
The Biden administration will have to pick which way to go. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore.
And in Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak
for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a nod to the political again. Italy's got a new prime minister. Not ordinarily, I know, something that would merit a mention on this program. Except the new incumbent is Mario Draghi, who until a year and a half ago was the president of the European Central Bank and before that was the governor of the Bank of Italy. Imagine, if you will, through some constitutional quirk, former Fed chair Ben Bernanke getting the top job here. Or better yet, Janet Yellen, who is now actually in the line of presidential succession and who, not for nothing, has had a really catchy rap song written about her. Who's Yellen now? It's called. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Anyway, here is your Friday moment of economic context. Ali Pham, our intern who you've heard in the show credits the past year or so, wrapped things up with us yesterday, flew home from L.A. on what she said this morning because she joined our Zoom for old time's sake, I guess. Anyway, she said it was an uncomfortably crowded flight, which gets me to my old standby, the Transportation Security Administration numbers. Yesterday, including Ali, 1,034,514 passengers were screened, the first time over a million since just after New Year's. A year ago yesterday, right before things shut down, almost 2.5 million. Our theme music was composed by... yes, BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. And I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.